Hello, welcome one and all. I'm Philip Stubley, host of The Bear Den, where we talk about pretty much all about bears and other wildlife. At the moment, we are continuing our journey in Indonesia, finding out about sun bears and showcasing some of the individuals I've met over the years working in conservation who are out there making a difference. In previous episodes, I talked about my own personal experiences with sun bear rehabilitation, and we've had Jakarta Animal Aid Network founder Femke Den Haas join us. If you haven't already, I'd recommend listening to them as well. In this episode, we welcome Patrick Ruxell into the Bear Den. He's a wildlife filmmaker, conservationist, and founder of the charity Sun Bear Outreach. And he has done so much for rescued sun bears all across Indonesia over the years. So, let's dig in. There is a place in the remote northwoods of Minnesota, North America. It's located near the town of Orr, population approximately 300. Outside of this town is an area where normal rules are put to one side. It's a place where humans and wildlife meet. It's a special place, wholly unique, and not without its controversies. This is the Vinschuti Wildlife Sanctuary, run by the American Bear Association, ABA for short. The ABA is dedicated to promoting a better understanding of black bears and all wildlife through education, observation, and experience. I'm your host, Philip Stubley, and welcome to the Bear Den. So yeah, just to blow smoke up your ass a little bit to start with, I can't think of any single person that's done more for sun bears in Indonesia than you, Patrick. You're a filmmaker and founder of Sun Bear Outreach. And I'll stand by that assertion, by the way. Like, even growing up, you've lived a fairly nomadic life. And I just wondered if you could fill us a little bit in. Well, introduce yourself, please, and also fill us a bit in on your background and early life.
Okay, well, thank you for the compliment. I don't think I've done so much for the sun bears in Indonesia. Unfortunately, I've only helped a few individuals have a better captive life and maybe one or two go back to the wild, but that's about it. But in terms of, so my background, well, I was born in France. My mother is Swedish, my father French. I grew up in Kuala Lumpur in Singapore back in the 70s and early 80s. Then I went to the States for 3 years, did a bachelor in humanities, came back to France, began medical school because I thought, oh, I could be working for Médecins Sans Frontières and be a doctor and heal people around the world and travel. But I hated medical school, so I gave up and started working in the film industry. When I lost my father, I was 25 years old, made my way up in the film industry, in the special effects, post-production stuff. It was all good and well, living in Paris, making money, had a nice girlfriend, car, an apartment. And then at about 40 years old, I remember in the subway in Paris going to work, I thought, oh, I don't want to do this all my life. This sucks. What would I like to do? And I thought, well, my dream job would be to make wildlife documentary films. So I bought a camera, one of those first digital cameras that was on the market, and went off to Indonesia because it seemed like an easy destination for me, having grown up in this part of the world, and started filming the orangutans in Sumatra, then in Borneo. This was back in 2002, 2003. I made quite a number of films on wildlife conservation, both in Southeast Asia, but also in the Congo Basin and in the Amazon. Then one day I came across one little sun bear cub, who was brought to this rescue center where I was working, making a film on orangutans again. Well, I started taking care of the sun bear cub, and before I knew it, I was very much attached to this little innocent being, and thought, okay, what can I do for her? And well, the best thing I could do for her was try and give her a second chance and bring her back to the forest. So that's what I decided to do. And thanks to an organization over there called OFI that helps orangutans also, I was able to bring this cub back into the forest in a national park in South Borneo, and spent some time with her there. in what is called a slow release program, which means that you become the foster mother of the cub, and the cub follows you in the forest until he or she is old enough to survive by its own and takes its independence. Unfortunately, after a few months of that, things didn't go very well. Series of events happened, and I ended up losing the cub, not knowing what it became. I had no tracker at the time. I couldn't just, you know, look at the GPS point on my computer because there was none. After that kind of mixed feeling experience, I thought I would try again, and helped another organization with two other cubs and brought them to the forest. And one of them unfortunately died after just 3 weeks, killed by a male resident there.
These were two, a male and a female sun bear cub that you took.
Yeah, this was a male and a female. So the male didn't survive long. He had three good weeks in the forest, the best weeks of his life, I'm sure, because he was a good old chap, a lovely little cub, but just too innocent and didn't understand the rules of the forest, because it's one of the hard things about releasing cubs to the wild is that you can't teach them how to avoid the territory of wild resident bears, because you have no idea where the territories begin or stop, because it's all scent marks, which, you know, a mother bear would smell and let her cub know one way or another. But us humans, we had no idea. We don't smell anything when we're in the forest. We just walk around and walk into territories where we shouldn't be. And then, well, as soon as we have our backs turned and are a little far away from the cubs that we're supposed to protect, the wild males especially, who are quite aggressive, and rightly so, because they have little food and little habitat to survive in. Well, they don't want newcomers. The female, luckily, I think she made it, because she gradually took her independence, and the separation was progressive. So that was nice. At the end, after about a year walking in the forest with her, she would just go off for a few days on her own and come back to camp, and then go off again for a longer time and then come back when she was hungry. And sometimes I was in the forest looking for her, and this time I had radio signal for these cubs, and I could hear the radio signal, I remember once, coming closer and closer to me, and I thought, oh, it's little Bernie coming back to see daddy. And I was so happy that she, you know, she would come back to me, and the radio signal was coming closer and closer, and suddenly I see her through the bushes, and there she is, and she walked just past me and continued walking. and she didn't need me anymore, so she didn't bother to stop and give me a cuddle. She just lived her life, and I was a bit heartbroken, but then again, I was very happy, because it meant that the release was a success, and that she could, you know, she was being a bear again, a wild bear. Mm-hmm. She just wasn't afraid of me, but she was doing her life and didn't need me anymore. So that was a good moment. That was about 10 years ago. Since then, I've been helping improve the welfare of captive sun bears in different sanctuaries in Indonesia, trying to give these sun bears access to a bit of the rainforest by making large enclosures, outdoor enclosures with electric fencing, so that these guys can enjoy a bit of their natural habitat and sleep in the trees at night if they want to, and not be stuck in a cage, basically.
Thanks.
That's what I do.
Yeah, no, that's it's a really big overview. You've answered quite a lot of the questions I had coming up. But you're rehabilitated and released the three bears of the wild with varying degrees of success, obviously. And I know that it's really hard. But you also made a film called Life is One, and that was about the sun bears. And I think it focuses a bit on those releases as well, doesn't it?
Yeah, when I went back in the forest with the two litter cubs, Bernie and Wawang, I took a camera with me this time and filmed the whole thing. So yeah, Life is One is about that experience. What can I say? It's not the best film I did, but it was the one I enjoyed most doing, because it's probably not the best film I did because it was more important for me to be with the Cubs and to have a successful release, rather than to get the right footage and make a good film. So,
of course,
you know, you have to know where your priorities are. But it was, I must say, it was the most beautiful experience in my life to release these Cubs back to the wild. Because it was it's like a 24-hour commitment, you know, 7 days a week, nonstop for month and month and month, alone in the forest with these Cubs. And you become a bit wild yourself. And I enjoyed that very much, this experience of giving everything you have, like a mother would give, to this one little individual. When it's successful, it's very gratifying. And when it's not successful, then it's very heartbreaking.
Yeah, I mean, I know how that feeling. Yeah, it's very hard when it doesn't go the way you want it. But when it does, it's like, yeah, like you say, it's one of the happiest moments of my life. I think was when I found Boo Boo. You know, it had been 6 months since I'd seen her, and she was just surviving and thriving, it seemed like, in the forest. But I know you've said that, being very self-deprecating, saying that Life is One's not your best movie, but there is another one, an award-winning movie called Green, which I imagine you're quite proud of. And that one was one you did quite a while back, more focused on orangutans. I just wondered if you wanted to sort of describe that a bit, and then what went into the making of that?
Well, I don't like the word proud very much, but it was a good movie. Yes, and it still is. That's the nice thing about good movies, is that they survive in time, because this movie was from 2007, I believe. So yeah, almost 20 years now, but it's still appropriate today, and you can still watch it without thinking, oh my God, this is so old.
One of the good things about it is, I mean, there's no real narration to it. It's all visual. So, you know, it transcends any sort of language barriers, and it is just like an experience. That's how I felt.
Well, it was filmed from the point of view of a female orangutan, which I managed to come across by chance when I was in one of those sanctuaries. I remember walking in this room, and there was an orangutan lying on her back with an IV drip in one of her arms and a little towel as a blanket. And she even had a cushion to hold her head. Kitty something, you know, that brand, I forget what it is. Well, one of those cushions that we've seen everywhere. And she reminded me of my grandmother when I saw her, because orangutans are very human-like, of course. And I felt sorry for her, and I tried to imagine what could be going on in her head, what she was, you know. So I spent a lot of time in there just filming her lying down on her mattress and receiving care from the vets and the other keepers. And, well, of course, I imagined what, you know, she could be thinking of, and kind of made the film around that. The good thing is that when you don't have narration, is you can better share emotions, because with words it goes to the brain, but with just images and music and sounds, the message goes more to the heart. And so many people who watch this film cry because it's sad, of course, but also because it touches people. I know that had I made a film with words and statistics and numbers and whatever, there wouldn't have been as many tears, that's for sure. It was one of the first films I did, and I've never quite managed to equal that. So maybe I should have stopped then.
You peaked too soon.
But I'm actually missing the creative part of making films, because since I've been working with the Sun Bears, improving their welfare, well, I haven't been filming a lot. I've only done a few little things here and there. And I'm now actually thinking of going back to filmmaking and doing more films, because I miss it. So we'll see.
Green too. Or
green too, or brown, or some other color.
Yeah. It's interesting you say that. You said when you you met this sun bear cub and then you instantly wanted to help it. And then, so why is it that why did you stick with sun bears? What is it about them?
It's a good question. I don't really know. I guess one of the first things was that sun bears are really neglected in the world of conservation. Hardly anybody even know that they exist. And so there's like a void of things going on for them. There's a lot going on for the orangutans, for the elephants, for the tigers, for all these magnificent species. But the sun bears, it's like they're forgotten. And so I thought, okay, I want to try and remedy this. But it's also, I've grown attached to them because they're so loving. They're so like dogs in a way where they're always positive, they're always giving. And at the same time, it's even more beautiful than a relationship you could have with dogs because it's a one-to-one relationship. You will never be the master of a bear, and the bear will never be, in a form of submission to you. It's a kind of mutual trust that you learn to build and grow, and it's work both ways. So I enjoy very much that relationship, both with the cubs, but also with adult bears, where adult bears with time learn to trust you and you to trust them. And I just get attached to them. And that's why it's difficult to, that's why I'm still there doing what I'm doing. I feel sorry for them. I feel sorry that most of these sun bears can't be released back to the wild because they wouldn't have a chance of survival. So the only thing you can do for them is give them the best possible captive situation.
We met at OFI and I was grateful when you came because I think I'd been there a few weeks and I was kind of finding my feet still. And you sort of, there wasn't really anyone to sort of tell me what I should be doing. So I definitely learned a lot from you when you came. Obviously, you've been instrumental at improving the living conditions of those captive sun bears at that facility, and we've done some work there together. And then you've also been at East Kalimantan at a facility, Bornean Orangutan Survival Foundation. Again, I've sort of joined you on and off for stints over the years, and you've been at that facility now for how long?
For 10 years.
What was the situation like when you got there then? I mean, how many bears are there? I mean, obviously there's been some work to do if you've been there for that long. I just thought you might give us a bit of an idea about that. How were the conditions? How did you enact any changes there?
10 years ago, when I got there were about 40 bears in captivity. And most of them were stuck in tiny little cages. What I did was I proposed to turn the situation around, and thanks to the organization itself and thanks to donors from around the world, we managed to build more than 20 large forest enclosures over an area of about 16, 17 hectares of forest, turned the situation completely around. And today, if you're going to be a captive sun bear in Indonesia at Bos Samboja Lestari, you'll have access to the forest. You'll be able to sleep in the trees if you want to. You'll be able to get away from the humans and stay all day out in an enclosure where nobody can see you, and you have other bears to play with, but enough space to be alone if you want to be alone. And the diet is now much better than it was used to be. And it's like it went from being a one-star hotel to a five-star hotel. Mm. And it's a good place to be for Captain Sun Bear.
It's like a big job. I mean, who do you rely on to work alongside to get all this done?
You know, Boss is a big organization, and all the bears belong to Boss. And so they have the staff and the funding for the food and salaries and you know, everyday running of the place. And as far as the construction goes, well, then I looked for funds, mostly from abroad, but also from offices, because BOSS has different offices around the world, which are there to raise funds for them. And so my biggest support came from BOSS Switzerland. And they had big donors in Switzerland who were sensitive to the bears themselves and not only the orangutans. And so they helped me out a lot. And I have my own charity called Sun Bear Outreach.
Oh, good. I know. I realized I hadn't mentioned that for a while. I was going to ask about that. Yeah, good. Yeah.
Well, it's only a small charity, you know, with a website and a bank account, but it allows me to raise funds independently for the bears. And so with that, I have also my list of followers and donors that I can reach out to when I have different projects. You know, I work with local contractors when it comes to actually doing the buildings and the infrastructures and stuff on the ground. And I'm always on the ground as construction happens to make sure that it all goes well. That's one of the important things in Indonesia and maybe all around the world, is that if you're going to build a house or an enclosure or whatever, it's good to be there when the building happens, because decisions have to be taken all the time. And I supervise construction work and make sure things are as planned. For the last 10 years, have been going from one project to another, and things have been going on relatively smoothly up to now.
Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, you've mentioned obviously you oversee the construction, but like, what's a typical day? Like, what's your daily routine then?
Now my daily routine is mostly maintenance. There are four guys on the team who are there solely for maintenance of all the enclosures. And maintenance is a big thing, because in the rainforest, you know, nature is very good at destroying whatever you build. So, and it's a hilly environment with very heavy rains. So it's important that the rain can go into the enclosures and out of the enclosures without getting stuck somewhere and destroying everything when it does get stuck on its way. A lot of just cleaning drains and keeping the vegetation at bay. And then also I focus on the welfare of the bears, making sure that little things, but just that they get the proper food and water and enrichment. And when we receive cubs at the center, which we receive about 2 a year on average, sometimes they arrive, they're only a few weeks old, where their eyes still closed and they can hardly walk and they need care 24-hour. So I do a lot of that, caring for the cubs. I sometimes go on for month and month with just around the clock. You know, I do maintenance during the day. I come back in the afternoon and take over a cub and give it the bottle every 3 hours during the night, and then start again the next day, going back to maintenance. And yeah, it's 100% dedication to these little guys.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, how is it then, like, when you kind of leave that environment or the wilderness and you go, say, a break in a bigger city, what thoughts occur? Like, how different is that?
Well, you know, I grew up in cities, both in Kuala Lumpur and Singapore, and spent more than 20 years in Paris. So, you know, it's not like I'm Mowgli and coming back.
No, I guess not.
Well, I know that I couldn't go back to living in a city, in a big city. Especially what bothers me is the crowds. And it's getting more and more crowded everywhere. The planet, and especially Southeast Asia, is like crazy crowded. I hate going to Jakarta, for example, or Bangkok, or any other big city in Southeast Asia. Just want to go out because there's just too much traffic, too much people, too much sounds. It's like so overwhelming. I tend to look for quiet places. When I go back to France, which is my home country, I just go to the countryside in a little village where I have a cottage in the woods and stay there and avoid going around too much, because
all you need is a little animal to care for, and then it's kind of like you're back in Borneo, really, right?
Yeah, there's always an animal to care for.
Yeah,
when I was in France just a month ago, I was taking care of a very old cat who's at the end of its life, but Well, it's so easy taking care of a cat compared to a sun bear, so
Yeah,
it's
they're a
nice.
little less bitey sometimes. But
Yeah.
how many bears? I know you said they had about 40 bears when you
Oh,
first arrived
right.
at Boss. How many do they have now?
76.
76, and you've got about 17
Yeah.
hectares worth of enclosure. And I mean, this is just, I don't know if this is really interesting for listeners, but I'm interested. I kind of wanted to talk a little bit about the enclosures and just ask about, you mentioned obviously the electric fence, how the bears kind of get used to the electric fence there. Do they generally avoid them once they've learned it can shock them, or are they constantly kind of checking it out?
No, luckily, because there's a lot of electric cuts in the on the grid here in Singapore, so it often happens that electricity is off for the whole night or even 24 hours sometimes, or just a few hours a day. So luckily, the bears don't check on the wires, but the learning is unfortunately the hard way. We have these small enclosures we call training enclosures, where they're just a few square meters. Maybe the enclosure is like 10 meter by 10 meter, okay, let's say. And so we put them in there, and of course the first thing the bears do is want to check out, climb over the fence, and they get zapped and they get upset. And sometimes they run back to their den and don't want to go out again. Sometimes they just walk away and try on another spot and get zapped again. We monitor the way they behave, and after 5 or 6 zaps, usually they understand and they won't touch those electric wires anymore. Once they've understood where the pain actually comes from, then we can put them in a larger enclosure, and they'll recognize those electric wires that run along the mesh that define their space. And maybe in those big enclosures, they'll try once, but usually they don't even want to get close to those enclosures. And even when a tree falls, which happens regularly, falls on the fence and could serve as a bridge for the bears to escape, they don't even dare climb that tree and get close to the wire. Luckily, yeah, with all the trees that have fallen, and it's like, 2 or 3 trees a year always fall and half break the mesh and the fence. And but luckily, to this date, there's been no escape that way. Where the way they usually try to escape from the enclosures is by digging. And they're good at digging, so the foundation of the fences have to be quite deep. We have had a few escapes from bears who climb from one branch to another, from the tall trees in the enclosures. At first, there's no way for them to climb over, but with time, the branches grow, and we tend to forget to look up and see the possible escape routes. But the bears, they are themselves up in the trees, and they're very good climbers. And so some bears escape that way, because sometimes it takes just the tiniest little branch connecting to an outside tree to another little branch from another tree outside. And if that branch can support their weight, then they're off.
Yeah.
Especially the cubs. Yeah.
Oh yeah. Oh no, I've
So.
had a few experiences with bear escapes, which don't could do without, but
Yeah.
it's they're generally though they're not like they don't make a break for it. They kind of just they'll wander about and go, oh, they'll just look for some food, and if they find some, normally it's quite nearby, they might just stop and start eating, which gives you a chance to get them and get them back in.
Yeah, luckily, they are completely obsessed with honey, the sun bears. In fact, in Indonesian, they are called honey bears. And most of the bears that escape, that are not apprehensive, or that are not, what can I say? They're not that you can easily get close to, that won't charge or attack. Most of these bears, we just open a bottle of honey and they smell the honey, and they'll follow you right back into their enclosure, no problem, because they just want the honey and they're not thinking. They're in the present moment. They're not thinking, oh, if I go back in the enclosure, I'll be locked in again.
They're very open and honest animals, bears, I find.
Yeah. And naive, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh yeah, yeah, so you've reminded me actually of there was a time I know that you were back in France and I'd gone to Boss to help oversee being building of an enclosure, and there was one enclosure that had 12 sun bears in, and it had been closed because there was the drain was completely blocked and the electric fence wasn't working, and so I managed to sort of corral people to get the drain unblocked. And that was a lot of digging, not digging mud out of this little storm drain. And then it was very much a case of we need to like comb every inch of this electric fence to find out why it's not working. And it was very much there was one tiny section where I think within the wires had just come apart, and then it was literally a case of cut that bit off, then rejoin it, and it was and then it worked. And it was just like this tiny thing, but by the time I got there, it'd been about a month or a couple of months. The bears hadn't got out, and had been sort of stuck in there and sleeping enclosures. But luckily, that was quite nice. Sort of like great. Let's like that was very much at the top of my mind all the time. Just like just get these bears out into this back in the forest enclosure.
Yeah, I remember that part. That was at the end of the COVID when I wasn't around, and maintenance was kind of neglected.
I know. I was sorry to hear that. I'll say Pak Alias, the head bear keeper at Boss, recently passed away.
Yeah, he had been working at Samboja Lestari for over 20 years. He was there in the very beginning when they received their first bears, so he knew them all. He was like living memory of the center. He was a very nice chap to work with. At first, it was a bit difficult because he was a bit skeptic about me coming in and explaining how we were going to do things. But with time, he saw all that we could achieve together. And so we got quite close. And it was a good partner to have. And every time I left, he was a guy I would contact to get news on the bears, find out what was going on. And he died very suddenly at work, actually. I saw him in the morning. We had our little chat, morning chat, as we always do. And I told him I was going to far section of the sanctuary to check on the enclosures over there. He was going to stay where he was just to give out food to the bears. And half an hour later, he had a stroke and fell to the ground, was brought to the hospital, and died soon after. And I learned about it just an hour later. It was all so sudden. He was there 1 minute, gone the next.
Yeah, it's very sad.
And in Indonesia, they bury their dead very quickly. It has to be done within 24 hours. So, it happened in the morning. In the afternoon, there was a ceremony at his home. His body was actually there on the ground, and everybody came to pay their respects. And his wife was in tears. And the next day, he was buried. And suddenly, the main character of the Sun Bears at Samboja Lestari was gone. So I shortly after that left to France. I haven't quite really been there. I haven't actually been there since. So I'm sure things have changed. There's a new equilibrium. Maybe somebody has been chosen to replace him.
Yeah, I hope so.
I know that it will never be the same anymore.
Yeah. I mean, I'm wondering. Yeah. I'm trying to think out of the people that are there who would step into his shoes. I don't know, see. But I was gonna ask if there were any sort of standout bears or stories that came to mind that you wanted to share.
Yeah,
I mean, I'm sure there's a lot.
Which one to choose? I mean, all the cubs we receive are always cutest than the last cub. And it's always such a sad story, because when you receive a cub, you say, oh, what a lovely little creature. But at the same time, well, that cub shouldn't be there. It shouldn't be with me giving it the bottle. It should be in the forest with its mother. And there's something so absolutely wrong with the way things are, because all these cubs come from the wild. It's always the same story. You know, the mother is killed and the cub is taken for the wildlife trade. And most of them end up in mini zoos around the world or in Indonesia because, you know, private rich assholes, if I can allow myself to say that word, pay for these cubs and want to own them as kind of a living trophy they have in their backyard with other wildlife. And a few, like the tip of the iceberg, get caught by customs. A few of the poachers, I would say, get caught by the police or the customs or whatever. And then the cubs are confiscated and ended up at Boston. So of these cubs, of course, yeah, many stand out because the relationship is very strong when you take care of them 24 hours a day. But I think, well, the ones that will stay in my heart the longest are the ones that I release back to the wild, especially Bernie, the one that was successful. I remember she once got in a fight, probably with another wild bear, and was wounded and went hiding. Because in those releases, the idea is that every evening we would come back to the night cage next to the camp, and then the cub would spend the night in the cage in a safe, you know, closed environment. And then early morning at sunrise, we'd go out and go for a forest walk and come back at the cage at night again until the bear is old enough to not want to come back to the cage. But she was still very young and she was wounded and she was so traumatized that she just went off and went hiding in a very dense, damp area of the forest. And I couldn't get her out of that place where she was hiding. And so I left her there the first night, came back alone to the camp and went back in the morning and couldn't find her. And she had moved to another place where she was also hiding. But she wouldn't allow me to get close to her because she was wounded. All I could do was leave food in a plate and, you know, put antibiotics in that plate for her to get in her body so that she wouldn't, all her wounds wouldn't go infected. And it lasted for almost 2 months of this, just hiding and not coming out and not wanting me to be close to her. And so I would just, you know, respect her, her desire and just wait, not too close, not too far. She knew I was there, but I didn't insist. And then when night came, I'd leave food for her for the night and then went back to camp and tried to find her the next day. And I remember one day, and it was my birthday, I was just laying down on the ground, waiting for the day to pass. And she came out of her den and laid down on me. Like, you know, of all the places she could have decided to have a little nap and lie down, it was just on my belly. And I felt so grateful. I felt so grateful. It was like the best birthday present I ever had in my life because, you know, she was like a wild bear and she could have gone anywhere, but no, she came and like, saying thank you because I kind of had saved her life. I don't think she would have managed had she been alone because all she did was hide. She didn't look for food. So she would have gone weaker and weaker and her wounds would have gone infected. And yeah, it would have probably been the end. So she probably knew that, you know, I think she was thankful and she came to say thank you. And it was a very beautiful moment, one I'll always remember. I hardly dared pat her or touch her. I didn't want to, you know, break that moment of beauty and peace. And I think I forget how long actually she napped, maybe 20 minutes, half an hour, and then went back on her feet and went off again. And actually that day she followed me back to the camp. She didn't want to go in her cage for the night, but at least she followed me back to the camp, and we went back to that normal routine of taking daily walks. That was the last day of her hiding. Yeah, it was a beautiful moment.
No, that is lovely, yeah. No. What's next for Sun Bear Outreach? I know that you're currently in Java right now and heading back to Borneo, but what's do you have any ideas particularly about what's happening next?
Well, the thing is that the organization boss, where I've been helping out for 10 years, the organization doesn't want to build more enclosures and receive more bears. And so I've kind of come to the end of what I can do for them. And I'm thinking of moving on. And in the last few years, I fell in love with elephants. I went to Laos a few times and discovered Asian elephants over there, and went to Sri Lanka. And I think I want to move on and see what I can do for the elephants. I think I also need a change. I can't really abandon the bears, so I'll continue coming back to Indonesia on a regular basis, I think, and make sure that everything's okay for the bears at Boss, but it's time for me to move on, I believe. And so elephants will be next.
Oh,
I'm not
well.
too sure how, but I feel it inside. This is where I have to go.
Yeah. I know your movies like Life is One and Green are available on your website, the Sun Bear Reach website, which I will put some links to in the show notes.
Actually, it's not the Sun Bear Outreach
Is it not?
website.
Oh, is it your
No.
personal one? Is it?
Yeah, my personal one, which goes by my name, patrickrooksell.com,
Ah, well, good.
or yeah, .com, yeah.
.com or it's sunbearoutreach.com as well.
.org for Sun Bear
.org,
Outreach.
of course, yes.
Yeah.
So I'll put some links in the show
So.
notes for that. I mean, do you ever imagine a time you wouldn't be doing this kind of work now? I know obviously you said you had that epiphany when you're on the train in Paris, but I mean, do you ever wish you could sort of unsee what you've seen and go back to a comfortable life like that?
No, I don't regret a moment of the decision I took. No, I'm very happy. It's just that it's emotionally it's difficult because, well, when you work in wildlife conservation, you're just fighting a losing battle. And the situation in Indonesia is pretty depressing for wildlife, and things are not going the right way. The forest is continuing to be destroyed, and so, yeah, it's not always easy emotionally. So you need to have that strength to continue, even though you know that at the end of the day, you'll lose the war.
Yeah,
But
but I suppose you've got to focus on the individuals you're helping, and I mean, nothing worth doing is ever easy sometimes, isn't it?
yeah,
Yeah.
that's what I do. I do focus on the individuals, and they give me the strength. When I see those bears that, 10 years ago were completely going crazy, stuck in their little cages and skinny and really, really bad. And now they're, kind of happy in a big enclosure and healthy and playing with other bears. So I said, okay.
It's always lovely to see when bears kind of know they're safe and they're happy and all's well. Yeah.
Also.
Thanks once again to Patrick for coming on and sharing his experiences and touching personal stories. You can check out his wildlife films, including Green and Life is One, on his website, patrickrochelle.com, or searching for them on YouTube. And you can find out about Sun Bear Outreach at sunbearoutreach.org. Next time, I'm joined by another friend from Borneo, Adrian, who has worked as a zookeeper and animal trainer for over a decade, and together we discuss how beneficial this can be for rescued bears and for humans and bears to learn to communicate with one another. I'm Philip, and this is The Bear Den. See you next time. The Bear Den, the American Bear Association podcast, was written and presented by me, Philip Stubley. The music was composed by React Music. Thank you to everyone who has helped make this podcast possible, including Karen Hauserman, Bill Lee, Clary Lee, Stephanie Horner, Donna Brazinka, Ross Coyer, and Angie Page. You can find out more about the American Bear Association at americanbear.org. You can find Binshuti Wildlife Sanctuary on Facebook and Instagram. You can ask questions and submit comments about the podcast to pstubley@americanbear.org. The ABA is a special circumstance. We do not condone feeding wild animals. If you enjoy this podcast, help support the ABA either by donating, becoming an ABA member, symbolically adopting a bear, or come visit the sanctuary during the season and say hello. And if you do enjoy this, please do us a favour. It'll barely take you a minute. On whatever platform you're listening to this on, please either follow us or click the bell for updates and notifications. Please share with family and friends and rate the podcast, as it all helps us grow and is greatly appreciated.